I'm Angel, passionate birth worker and podcast host of the Birth Rebel podcast. I'm bringing you a blend of heart, soul, and a bit of controversy. Join me on my podcast where I dive fearlessly into thought-provoking discussions about the most controversial topics in pregnancy, birth, breastfeeding, and postpartum. I'm unmasking the truths. I'm challenging norms and sparking conversations that matter. Let's celebrate the beauty of the perinatal space while fearlessly confronting the tough questions together. Tune in for guest interviews from health professionals leading the charge into changing the perinatal space and my own expertise in diverse topics. All right, Birth Rebel, let's jump into it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Birth Rebel podcast. I am back from maternity leave after an amazing home birth with baby number 6, and I'm really, really excited to just kind of jump right back into it and, you know, talk about the different controversies surrounding birth, the challenges, and all the things that is going on in the birth world and the breastfeeding world and just the perinatal space in general. So I'm really happy to be back. I actually have little Mila with me, so you guys might hear baby noises. She's just my extra guest on the podcast.
She's your producer.
Yeah, exactly. So I have a really amazing guest today, and I'm really, really excited to have Nathan Riley on my podcast. I should really get a sound button where I just have like the applause. Like, I've always wanted that. I came to know Nathan through one of my business mentors, Kylie, and then I heard about his podcast. So I've heard him on his podcast, and then I met him in person at the Breach conference that you had. Yeah, how was that?
The 2003, the Born Free Twins Breach conference. It was a huge hit. It was so much fun, and it was so good to meet so many people like you in person. I mean, nowadays we're being so isolated, it's so nice to actually like hug and hold hands and to shake hands and to like be in a room with other like-minded people and even not like-minded people. It's just good to be in a room with other people who are sort of equally invested in this conversation around maternity care. So it was really, really nice to meet you. We're going to do it again in 2024 for those listening. So clear out your schedules, August 8th through the 12th. We're focusing on traditional midwifery this time. Whereas in 2023, there was far more OBs. Well, not far more, 4 to 2 OBs to midwives. Now it's going to be far more midwives. A couple international midwives are coming in for the as speakers, and it's going to be bigger and better than ever. So we'll hope to see everybody there.
Yeah, it was so much fun. And it was just so great to kind of meet everyone. I mean, we had some celebrities of the birth world. We had Gail Tully.
Yeah,
Gail. I was like, what? Gail's here. that was pretty awesome. So yeah, tell me about your background, you know, how you came to be an OBGYN, and even more so, how did you become to be like the holistic OBGYN?
You know, I think a lot of people, you meet each other at a cocktail party, right? And you are, you know, getting some punch or whatever. I don't know, punch just sounds very old fashioned. You're going over to the drink area or the beverages. Like, everybody's trying to find some food, something to like be busy. And you meet a person and you say, what do you do? And most of the time, I think it's appropriate to say, well, I do this for a living. But really, who I am is I'm a father to 2 little girls, and I'm married to my high school sweetheart. And every single day, I have to wake up and figure out how I'm going to live the best version of my life that is sort of foreseeable, you know, for that day. And some days it means you get in a wreck on your mountain bike and you have a big shiner in your face while you're talking to Angel. Other days it means I'm hanging out with my little girls and I have to pay our mortgage and our car payments and make healthy choices and all of that. So from a professional standpoint, I am a board certified OBGYN. I'm also board certified in hospice and palliative medicine. So that gives me this very, very interesting niche, or at least a different way to look at birth, which is around the role of personal accountability for one, but also, hey, like there's more to this than just a medical procedure. And so if I were to go back, way back, and to really kind of reflect on who I was when I started my training, you know, that was about 15, 20 years ago. I'm a very, very different person now. Obviously, I do home birth now. I do a lot of functional medicine. You can use the word holistic, but now that term doesn't really mean much to people. But I what I will say is that from a physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual standpoint, there is something that can be done in order to ensure that you have the best experience from getting pregnant to having your sixth baby, whether it's in the home, in a birth center, in the hospital. And I am constantly on this journey to find interesting people that have really, really great clinical experience, and then training with them and trying to incorporate that into my own programs and into my own practice and into the care of my family. So that's me in a nutshell, I guess.
Yeah. And for the record to my audience, I did recommend that we, that he didn't, that we could have done this another time, but he's like, no, I am ready for this. Even though I just got into a motorcycle accident. He like,
no, mountain biking, not motorcycle. Okay. I'd probably be dead if it was a motorcycle.
Okay. Cause he texted me and I'm like, oh my gosh, like what? And he's like, no, it's fine. It's okay. It's okay. So I'm still like super excited to have you here. Even though you had your motor.
A little bit sore.
All right. So there is something that you talk about quite a bit, and it's actually something that I really, really love and love to listen to you talk about. And I really feel that it is an important aspect of birth. And you talk about radical responsibility, and even more so you talk about it in the terms of, in the space of birth and birth decisions and things like that. So can you kind of go a little bit more into like, what is your idea of radical responsibility and what does that mean in relation to the birth space?
Yeah. So I've gotten into a lot of trouble with this, you know, as I've been given a platform and my podcast is hugely popular now, and I'm getting invited on to, you know, to do interviews like this. I had a TikTok page. I had the Instagram. I've got a lot of followers there. I had a lot on TikTok and deleted that account because I realized that there is a really, really touchy point here, which is the conversation around personal responsibility, which I've now changed to personal accountability. And that, so this is a touchy subject, but here's what I'll say. Most people listening, most people that come to my conferences, most people enroll in my pregnancy and postpartum program, which is called the Born Free Method. Most people, the common denominator, they come from all backgrounds, all shapes and sizes and socioeconomic backgrounds and everything. Everybody shares this sort of same disdain for the conventional medical model and how we care for women who are going to have babies, 99% of which are happening in hospitals in the United States. And as a result, we're seeing our induction rates go up. We're seeing our C-section rate climb now closer to 40% nationally on average. And everybody wants to say, damn the doctors and the stinking certified nurse midwives and the hospitals, it all sucks. But then they don't want to take any accountability for what got them there in the first place. So I'm going to say this in the nicest way that I can, and I'm going to preface it with this. The most disruptive thing that you can do, if you share that disdain that Dr. Stu, one of my good friends and mentors, Dr. Chavira, that Dr. Hayes, that Betty Ann Davis, that Rick Zafries, that Gail Tully, that Nicole Morales, that Angel Coleman, that all of us share, the most disruptive thing you can do is to make that system obsolete. Now, does that mean that you just throw caution to the wind and you say, nonsense, my blood pressure is 200 over 110. I don't believe in strokes. Like, no. If you're sick, you go to the hospital. But hospitals are not there for prevention of disease, nor for the reversal of disease, and especially not for the care of 85% of women who are giving birth in our country, the vast majority of which are extremely low risk and could have a baby out in the woods and have no issues. But instead, they find themselves on this medical train because something was diagnosed, because somebody went looking for it, whether it was an unnecessary ultrasound, an unnecessary blood panel, whatever. And now suddenly, you're considered high risk just because you're older. Doesn't matter how thin you are. Doesn't matter what your blood sugar control is. Now you're high risk and you're on the medical train, and it's hard to get off that train. So the most disruptive thing you can do is to consider, what do I have to invest from the standpoint of resources, energy, willpower, in order to make sure that I don't need the hospital? And that might mean you have $1 million in the bank, Angel. It could mean you have $1 billion in the bank. I've taken care of a billionaire who ended up with an emergency C-section due to preeclampsia. This has very, very little to do, let's say, with resources. Yes, if you have a ton of money, sure, you could get all the fancy gadgets and gimmicks and all that other stuff and and give the impression that this is a socioeconomic problem. But the reality is, in most parts of the world, we are not seeing the rates of gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, hypertension, and all that. And those are completely, 100% without a doubt, preventable for most women. Yes. So what can you do? What can you do with your five extra dollars per month versus the million? You have to figure out. You have to be thoughtful. Treat your body like a temple. Where do those $5 get your greatest bang for your buck in order to ensure that you don't even need to look at a hospital, let alone step in there and have all of the interventions that lead to the catastrophic things that heroes in white coats come and save you from?
Really, the hospitals are there like for the emergencies, for the surgeries. They're amazing for surgeries. But when it comes to the prevention of medicine, then that's kind of where people find a wall, where we're asking our doctors, like, how do I prevent preeclampsia? Because this is something that I've talked about. And you hear that, oh, you can't actually prevent preeclampsia. And in fact, I know here in Cleveland, Ohio, they've done some things to like make screening earlier during pregnancy. And I remember sitting in a room with, you know, other doulas and nurses, and they're like, oh, we had this screening and we're so excited. Like, we can find preeclampsia earlier and we can start giving baby aspirin and blah, blah, blah. And I literally looked at everyone in the room and I'm like, but doesn't that mean that they're going to induce women more frequently?
Right.
And like, you could just see how I just let the air out of the balloon. And I'm just like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to bring it down, but that's the reality of it. That's the reality of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I think that when people hear us speak like this, I think that what they're presuming is that we're speaking from the lens of privileged white, you know, cis white males, right? Or females for that matter, right? Like, white people have ruled the world for a long time. And what I want to, you know, encourage people to consider is that, like, yeah, white people are also getting these things, but we have some systemic issues in medicine alone, right? Where I took an oath to take care of people. I had Black women and their partners coming in and requesting me specifically because I didn't make them feel like failures when they walked in. I was the crunchy granola guy who wanted to swab, you know, vaginal babies born by C-section, who would just sit there and just be patient and get to know people. And that trust is, I think, a big part of what's lacking. You know, we've got socioeconomic disparities. Where I trained in LA, you've got some of the biggest. You have millions of people living on the street. I mean, they've estimated tens of thousands. There is got to be a million people that are homeless or whatever, houseless, and or at least worried about how they're going to pay their next check in the county of Los Angeles. And you've got people that have $100 million car, you know, or houses up in the Hollywood Hills, just like a mile away. So we've got these disparities. We've got where I trained at Temple in Philadelphia. We've got food deserts. Temple University School of Medicine is a beautiful tens of million dollar building paid for by pharmaceutical companies and donors. And they displaced a whole bunch of people there, right? And they had to go and find other homes, right? Like, here's a $50,000 check. We're going to build a medical school here. So they didn't want us there. A bunch of like rich white and Asian and Black students. Like, I mean, not everybody who goes to med school is rich. I'm certainly not rich, but you know, the point here is that the hospital system doesn't really seem to take that into account, that you're already coming in super stressed out. You're going to be afraid of some sort of racist remarks, and heaven forbid you're overweight or you're over the age of 35. People treat you as automatically unhealthy. Now, here's something people haven't heard me say. I would rather take care of a quote, a person living with obesity who takes care of themselves than a person who's skinny and using Coke and eating fast food and doing whatever at the age of 25. I would take that person for a home birth any day. So this has nothing to do with your weight, fat shaming, being completely delusional around the realities of being a woman or a person of color in the United States. Like, heaven forbid you're a lesbian in a relationship with a trans partner. Like, good luck navigating a medical system that has sort of underpinnings of racism, like every single moment, every interaction you see in there. But still, with all of that still being true, you are the person giving birth. What power do you have? You've been outsourcing your power every day of your life since kindergarten. When are you going to say, you know what? I'm going to do this my way. because I actually know what's right for me. Your intuition is authoritative knowledge. And if you know that what you're eating isn't the best and you get preeclampsia and then you want to blame the doctors for inducing you, I'm sorry, but that extra $5 you have every month could go towards a whole pound of beef liver versus a bunch of really, really processed junk at the store. And I know it sounds like this is really hard, but nobody's going to do this for you. So we have to have a balance of personal accountability and radically reforming the way that our society treats people, first and foremost. If we can get those two things in balance, we are going to see our maternity woes vanish, disappear. But nobody's willing to do the personal accountability piece, and nobody within the system is willing to recognize and maybe even stand up and put their job on the line to say, we need to fucking change this thing. And I'm trying to do both of those. But because I'm on the fence, it's sort of like not being a red or a blue voter. You stand on the fence and you're like, guys, you're both wrong. You both have things that are right, and you both have things that you probably don't even realize you disagree on. I want you guys to come together, and we need to actually do this for the sake of caring for people better. Mm-hmm. And that gets you hit with stones on either side, Angel. And I'm sure you've experienced that because you've had an interesting journey as well. I mean, you know, you're in a relationship with a white man, right?
Right.
And you've got six children, you've had to navigate this. And I mean, you probably don't have as much money as a billionaire because you've got six children. Right. I certainly don't have that much money. If I wanted to get rich, I'd still be doing C-sections 40% of the time. Instead, I've maintained a C-section rate below 5%. It is not easy out there. Like, people are scrapping. So are we going to start fighting with one another? Or are we going to let the system know that, hey, we're going to make you obsolete, and we can do that. We have the power of the masses.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I see in my background, I kind of come from so many different backgrounds. You know, I went to a really nice school, but then I was also homeless when I was, you know, 20 years old, and homeless when I was 24 years old. And, you know, I come from like both privilege and not privilege. I've seen both extremes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen both extremes. But I just love how you say, like, you know, we have to take that responsibility, because even as a mom who I will tell you that with my first VBAC daughter, I wanted a VBAC so bad, and we don't have birth centers here. And when I was wanting to go for my VBAC, I literally had two appointments that day. I had an appointment to court for my rent and an appointment to my fetal medicine doctor.
Wow.
And they were both, and I didn't have a car, and here in Cleveland, you know, our transit system isn't like amazing, but so I didn't have a car, so I had to take the bus. So I had to go to my fetal medicine doctor appointment that first. So I went there, and I'm like, he tells me, we think that you have a placenta accreta. We think that your baby might be growth restricted, and you might have to have a C-section. And then if you do have an accreta, we're gonna have to take your whole uterus. And think you should have a C-section next week. Hold on a second. What? I don't even know if I'm gonna have a house today. Like,
Yeah.
And even in that moment though, because I wanted a VBAC so bad. I was like, okay, thank you, like, for the information. And I'm lucky to have had a fetal medicine doctor who is more about options than your typical fetal medicine doctor in OBGYN. He's like, look, if you change your mind, like, just call me, let me know. I'll put it on the schedule, but feel free. That was the first time I ever heard that you could even cancel a C-section appointment.
You just don't show up, Angel. That's the best way to cancel. Don't show up.
I was like, what? You can cancel that? Okay. And so, yeah, that day I was like, okay, well, let me think about it. Let me talk to my doctor, because honestly, it was just all a possibility. We didn't know for sure, because I'm like, how do we know if I have an accreta? Well, we don't really know. We just suspect that it's accreta. And then that day, I actually had missed my court time by like a couple minutes. And they're like, sorry, you got to get out. You got 7 days. And I had two kids with me already. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So even in that moment, though, I didn't even know where I was going to live. I had a job and things like that. And with the resources that I had, I checked out ICANN, you know, the International Cesarean Awareness Network. I had just become a doula. So I checked with my doula resources. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of money. I couldn't really you know, afford these things. But I found a doula who would take me for free. You know, the new doulas, they'll take you for free a lot of times, a lot of the doulas. And, you know, I, you know, decided, okay, what other resources can I have? So I got a second opinion. I called one of the VBAC doctors. I'm like, okay, you're at a different hospital and I'm at this hospital, but like, I have this going on. Can you like look at my chart and let me know what you think? And he did. He looked at my chart and he's like, you know what? You can do this VBAC. Like, you know, this is what we can do. This is our plan. If you do have an accreta, we'll have some blood standing by. How do you feel about an induction? Blah, blah, blah. And he's like, I'll call this doctor and, you know, I'll talk to this doctor. And he did. And we all set it up and I got my VBAC. I had my VBAC. And I also did not have an accreta. So, yeah. So I love that, like that responsibility, like you have those choices. We can work with the medical system, even though sometimes it may, you know, go against you. There are those resources and not all of those resources cost money. So, and yes, okay, so I had an induction. What if it went bad? I was okay with the fact that I might need a C-section because at least I had tried.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, I mean, you bring up some really good, I mean, there's so much to unpack in your story, right? But one part of your story that I think is most captivating is at some point, Angel, you realized, I don't have to go in for the C-section.
Right.
Right. Like, imagine that's a tremendous reclamation of your power.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you're a mother. And ultimately, at the end of the day, whatever happens to any of your babies through birth into the postpartum period, even from the moment you have the glimmer in your eye that you want to conceive, whatever ends up happening to that kid. And that's why the vaccine conversation is actually more important than the system and the quote, you know, people claiming people are anti-vax and all this stuff. That's why this is important, because the parents, they hear that there is a small risk that something's going to happen to their baby if they get, you know, a vaccine injected. And by the way, I'm actually with them now. I never thought I would be, but I'm hearing it now so often that it's like, guys, there is enough anecdotal evidence here that we need to reframe our thinking about this. Mm-hmm. But I'm only using this to illustrate the example that even if the risk is one in a million, you as the mother have to make the decision that feels right on the inside, because the government, the, you know, the social workers, all of the people that are there to pick up the pieces for you and help you, they're not really going to be there. They're not going to be the one who's going to be helping you care for a little baby. I have a client here who's a four-time prior C-section. She's pregnant again, accidental pregnancy, but they were in repeat C-section, repeat C-section, repeat C-section, and then bam, got pregnant again. But in the meantime, their fourth went in for their six-month vaccines. And within a couple days after those six-month vaccines, was paralyzed from the neck down. And she's like, he's a perfectly healthy kid who now can't walk, has a feeding tube, has a tracheostomy. There is nobody out there to help her. There is not enough food stamps that can take away the burden of responsibility for a family with already four kids to take, or three kids at the time, to take care of now a child who is like extremely disabled. So at the end of the day, whether it's about induction, it's about a medication or a vaccine or whatever other therapy or, you know, safety net is offered to you to ensure that you and your baby are happy and healthy when you leave the hospital, you are the one that has to live with the consequences of that decision. So it doesn't matter if you believe that accountability is fair to talk about, or if you think it's shame and guilt and blame, it doesn't matter what you think. Ultimately, the person who has the baby is and their partner and their family, they're going to be the ones that have to suffer the consequences. And fortunately, bad things don't happen very, very often. The good news is that if you can avoid getting on the medical train at all costs, right? Nobody wants to have a dead baby on their hands. But if there's not a good reason to jump on the medical train, you're probably less likely to have a bad outcome. That is what our data suggests. So what's in your power? Do you want to go and try to outdata your doctor? Or do you want to just skip appointments and say, to hell with it, I believe I'm going to have a good birth. That's fine. You can do that. Or you can do all of the things that I am coaching people on a daily basis, and I'm seeing incredible results, to simply avoiding that altogether. And that comes from some basic things, many of which are not even expensive. Nervous system balancing, sleep, stress management. I mean, there's not much sleep as a young parent. I get that. But what can you do? Can you take naps during the day? Can you not be stressing yourself out about other things? Can you give your adrenals, your hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis? Can you give it a break once in a while? Can you get off your phone? Can you stop pushing yourself to the limit such that you end up with some, you know, suboptimal consequence? Is there something in your power that you can do in order to make sure that you are avoiding all of those interventions that everybody's, you know, been talking about? There is plenty in your wheelhouse to do that.
Right. And I feel like you just kind of touched on the elephant in the room, right? No one wants a dead baby on their hands.
Yeah.
And I think that is what drives a lot of that, you know, the choices that people do, is that no one wants to have a dead baby. We want a live baby. I can't always say healthy baby because there are a lot of things that I can say about that too. But everybody wants an alive baby. And so how do you think that fear drives people's choices when it comes to what they want to do with their pregnancy and with their birth and their birth options and things like that?
I think because we've outsourced our power, right? And we haven't been willing, and this is another trigger for people, so I'm sorry, guys, but when you wake up in the morning, you can either act like a child or you can put on your big boy pants and you can act like a man or a woman for that matter. Adults make adult decisions. They do not look for other people to make decisions on their behalf. But again, because we've been conditioned to believe we have to raise our hand to go pee, we have to ask permission to do everything. You can refuse absolutely anything in the hospital, including the IV in your hand, as long as you understand the downsides, the potential consequences of that decision. I think that when you, like you did, you were like, I didn't know I could refuse that. When you start to act like an adult, and we have a lot of young children walking around in adult bodies right now, when you start to say, you know what? No, thank you. There is so much power in that. No, thank you. I'm going to do it this way. I'm the dad. I'm actually going to decide this for our family, but I appreciate all the information. Thank you. And then you walk away. Like, that's a really hard skill to develop. But when you do, it reflects a couple things. First off, that you're now the captain of the ship. And the reason OBGYNs say I'm the captain of the ship is because a lot of women and their partners are not willing to take responsibility for their decisions. They say, what would you do? And that's a reasonable question. But ultimately, they're not going to be there to take care of you if something goes terribly wrong. So it still has to be a decision that you make. It also reflects this sort of strange dilemma we have around saying no, reflects an inability for us to ascertain risk. And the reason we're not good at ascertaining risks is because we don't ever do risky things. So I was just in a mountain biking accident. Am I going to go and blame somebody in the park service because I wrecked and I smashed my face on a tree trunk? No. I went on my bike fast. I was going very fast because I wanted the thrill of that ride. And I made an adult decision to put myself in a risky position with the potential consequence that I'm going to wreck my bike and smash my face on something, and my hip and my knee and both of my shins and everything else. But the point here is that many of us don't take, we don't want to accept responsibility for our decisions. We're always looking to blame somebody else for bad things. And sometimes there are negligent doctors. There are negligent midwives. There are unskilled people advertising that they're highly skilled in breech or whatever else. I don't advertise that I do breech. I do breech if it's a surprise, because I'm not Stu Fishbein. I haven't done, you know, Christine Laura. I haven't done several hundred breaches. So there is some issue there, right, with how we're counseling, how we're providing informed consent based on our skills. But at the end of the day, you have to make the decision. And I, going back to your question, I think that fear is a big problem here, because when you give somebody there's a risk of uterine rupture. Why would anybody want to go through that, you know, like put their baby at risk? Because the risk is less than 1%. How many things do you do on a daily basis? You may not ride a mountain bike, but the risk of me wrecking was way over less than 1%. Like, there was a good chance I was going to get in a wreck, and it may not have been a serious wreck. Fortunately, it wasn't serious, but there was a risk there. So I took a chance that was over 1%, but it was still a greater risk that I wouldn't get into an accident. And yet somehow, whenever we throw the dead baby language, and I say dead baby intentionally, because I don't think we actually use the word death, dying, dead often enough in our culture, which makes it this sort of like mysterious thing behind the curtain. I've seen a lot of dead babies. I've seen a lot of dead people because I'm a hospice doctor. And if you can then reverse engineer your decision making to say, okay, if the risk of that happening is this, what is the risk of that not happening? We never look at it from the other side. So if your risk of your uterus rupturing, which is often cited as between 0.4 and 0.9% if it's a low transverse incision, I think everybody knows this data, that means it's a greater than 99% chance that it won't happen. And you could use that same exercise every moment of every day, especially when it comes to pregnancy and childbirth. And that's what I really wish people would focus on. Like, who cares about the less than 1%? There is a such a much greater chance that that won't happen. But we struggle with ascertainment of risk because we don't know who we're going to blame if that bad thing happens to us. So reclamation of power, I think, is the answer to both of those conundra.
Yeah. And something that I think my audience might want to know too is, because I have some doulas, I have some, you know, midwives that listen, and then I have parents too, but how do they deal with the pushback from the system, from the doctors, when they make these kind of decisions that might seem quote unquote risky?
Risky, yeah, yeah. So I'm pausing here intentionally, and I'm not doing it because I don't have an answer, but I want to give a clear answer, because a lot of people are posting stuff on Instagram. They're having podcast chats. You know, they took a weekend workshop and heard something really inspiring from a midwife who's well-known or whatever. And I think that I think an exercise would illustrate this. So the next time that somebody calls you on the phone and says, "Hey, Angel, there's this great movie in the theater right now. And it's Halloween season. I know you love horror films. Do you want to go and see this movie with me?" Right? You've got six kids. You've got a lot of reasons why you wouldn't go to a movie, right? And sometimes people invite me to movies and it's like, it doesn't start until 10:30. I'm like, guys, I'm like well into my second cycle of REM here. You know, like 10:30 is way too late. But instead, right, I'll be like, oh, you know, find some reason, right? To not give them a clear, "Hey, I really appreciate the invitation, but I'm sorry, I can't do it today. Like, I want to cuddle with my wife, or I want to play with my kids," or whatever the situation. So that person calls you up and you're going to scramble for some reason why you don't want to disappoint them. You don't want them to know that you don't want to go.
Right.
So if that exercise makes us uncomfortable, then practicing the alternative and just trying it out with your best friend, be like, "You know, Sam," or whatever, I just got in a mountain bike accident today, and that I've been wanting to see that movie for a long time, but tonight's not the best night. I'm just going to have to get to bed early." It's a no. And actually, when you're the person making a request, you appreciate a firm no. You don't have to be like, "No, dummy, I hate movies." You could just be like, "You know what? I don't have the money to go to the movies right now." Or you could be honest, but we're not honest with people. We've hidden behind our computer screens and whatnot that we've forgotten the basic sort of courtesies, the basic human decencies that help us get by in life. So what I would really encourage, so I don't have a great, you know, like I think that sort of that example illustrates why it's so hard. And I actually think, and this is what I train my clients and the midwives in my collaborator program, this is what I always say, is you have to start practicing, not the midwife, but your clients, they have to start practicing saying no about dinner plans, let alone you're actively in labor, and now they want you to sign a consent form and you can't even see straight because the pain is so intense or whatever. That's not the time to be practicing your first no thank you. But man, no thank you, and then shutting the hell up. No thank you, I'm good. No thank you, I appreciate it. No thank you, like, thank you so much for telling us that, but we're gonna hold off on that. That goes a long way, and the doctor is also gonna be appreciative. Okay, they said no. They can say whatever the hell they want about you. Their opinion doesn't matter. You're the one who has to take care of yourself and your family through this process. I think it goes for doulas as well.
Yes. Yeah. Because we're always trying to figure out, you know, how, you know, you have this provider who is like, I'm just like, well, that doesn't even make any sense. But, you know, they just kind of counteract with, no, well, I think this and I'm afraid of this. Because the doctors are also acting out of fear. And, like, I don't want anyone to think that, you know, like, I hate doctors or coming after doctors, because there are two sides to this. Just kind of like how you mentioned earlier, you know, there's the red and blue debate and things like that. And there, some things are good on one side, some things are bad on both sides, and there are some common grounds. But the doctors are, you know, they do care. They don't want to have, you know, that this birth to be like the last bad birth that they had, you know, yesterday or something like that. But they are reacting out of that fear, and they want to have the best outcome. And sometimes for them, the best outcome is to just do a C-section, because that's easier. We know that they know that they can pretty much avoid a lot of different things if they do just do that C-section. So,
well, Angel, let me talk to that, because that you brought up a really good point. So that then the other question, again, I think the reason that I would never say that I'm smart, but I would say that I have figured out certain things, certain principles about how to practice the way that I do, because out of necessity, because I'm doing things very differently from any OBGYN in the country. When you find a point of contention, whether it's political, I mean, heaven forbid we have another COVID-like thing happen. Somebody wants to talk about, you know, how terrible it is that you didn't vaccinate your kids, or that you did vaccinate your kids. I mean, like, there's always this weird binary of like right and wrong. And if you don't fit into their, what they consider right, you suddenly now are the, you know, enemy number one. Because this is basically my whole life, is addressing these controversial topics, which actually are the crux of what's keeping us all so sick and frustrated with the system. I always encourage people, consider what you're arguing for. Consider it from the point of view of the other person. This isn't empathy. This is actually a thought experiment. What is that doctor? Why is that doctor telling you this? They are not a robot. They have a family. They've probably had babies of their own. Why on earth are they pressuring you to do this thing? It's because they're afraid. They do not want a dead baby on their hands any more than you, but you guys have different solutions to the same problem. So are they doing this because they think that you're a dummy? Maybe, probably not. Are they doing this because they get paid more for C-sections? Actually, no. Most of us don't get paid more for C-sections. We get a package of money for every single prenatal client, and we do whatever we can with that money to get you from the moment you show up for the first visit all the way through the 6-week postpartum visit. There are exceptions, but most of the large HMOs where I trained at Kaiser, you get an episode of care, is what they call it, a package of money. And if you have to do a C-section, hey, that takes away from your profit at the end of the day, which should be an incentive, and it still hasn't made much of a difference because they go for volume now. But anyways, I digress. Are they trying to get rich off of your C-section? Are they afraid that somebody's going to get hurt? Probably something there. It's unlikely they think that you're totally stupid and unwilling to speak for yourself. But there is fear. And fear is like, if pain is the great equalizer, fear is the great divider. Fear makes us all think that we're on different teams. And it's because we have different solutions to the things that make us the most afraid. So from a standpoint of an OBGYN, let's say, you know, why does this doctor over the past month, why have they done 60% of their births by C-section? And before that, it was only 20%. Well, look at what happened at the shift. They probably had a baby that died, or they had an emergency C-section and the baby is on cooling right now. We know that from those experiences that there's changes into how we interpret fetal heart rate tracings, how we make decisions, our threshold for doing unnecessary C-sections. All of that changes because that bad thing happened. And heaven forbid you took an oath to take care of somebody and their baby died. So how could we like emotionally Aikido that? We can actually support the OBGYN. We can say, listen, I know that you're afraid of this happening. I know that you're worried about the uterus rupturing. I know that the risk of that happening is less than 1%. Have you considered that that means that there's more than a 99% chance of it not happening? Play into that. They're human beings. And they may have lost their way, but I have not lost hope in all the OBGYNs. Dr. Stu and I disagree on this. He's like, I think the system is long gone. But I'm 30 years, you know, earlier than Stu is in his career, you know? And I don't know if I have any other option but to remain optimistic. Does that mean I think everybody should have a hospital birth? I don't know. If it's the right thing for you, I support no matter what it is that you want. Do I think we're doing too many C-sections? Hell yes. Do I think we're doing way more harm than good by doing all these C-sections? Totally. Are the studies reflecting those harms, these traumas of strapping a woman down crucifixion style? of, you know, drugging her up when she gets nauseated so that she's lightheaded and can't hold her baby immediately after the baby's born? Do I think we're taking too much time? Do I think our technique in C-sections is leading to greater needs for opioids? Absolutely. Absolutely, I do. And I still have hope that if we can start to treat one another like people, we're probably going to be better off. Because this whole bad guys, good guys thing doesn't work. It doesn't work in Star Wars any more than it works right now in your OBGYN's clinic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, Dr. Stu is very vocal about his hope for the system. I don't know on my opinion on that. I have no idea on where I stand. I think money plays a factor, and I don't think it plays a factor for the OBGYNs as much as it does the administrations who are really kind of running things and pharmaceuticals and stuff. Yeah.
I know, as I was saying the thing about the C-section payments, I realized that I was kind of digging myself into a hole there, because if anybody out there wants to deny that our medical system is being run for profits over people, if anybody's going to deny that, they're living under some sort of rock. Like they just took their first college course and it happened to be taught by somebody who has something to gain, you know, financially from the medical system. There is no denying that. But the reason your OBGYN is doing all of these surgeries is not necessarily because they're making some sort of personal gain. The you know, administrative staff absolutely is making more money from their maternity unit than any other unit in the hospital. There's no doubt about that. But it's not the only thing that's helping that OBGYN counsel you when you're in their clinic.
So for the mom who is, you know, about to have her baby, what would be your best tips? Or for the OBGYN who is supporting, or the midwife who is supporting that mom, making decisions that they may or may not agree with, like what are some course of actions that you would suggest for them?
What I recommend people do is actually something I learned from hospice and palliative care, believe it or not. In order for me to serve you as a doctor, right, I've got this giant toolkit. I've got all these millions of dollars backing up whatever it is that I want to do. Like, I don't have to find some way to afford sterilization of the surgical instruments. I just have them. They're in the operating room right there. What I would recommend people do is to write something called an advanced care plan. So when you are faced with, let's say, cancer, right, your doctor is going to say, hey, listen, I think chemotherapy is the way to go here. We could alternatively do this or that or whatever. You might decide to go that path. But then as you start getting sicker, you start to write down your story. And the writing down of that story helps anybody who comes into your care team understand who you are in a matter of maybe 250 words. The idea of a birth plan does that job, right? An advanced care plan at end of life is a surrogate for you if you lose the ability to sort of speak for yourself, right? It helps guide your closest kin, your husband or your sister, whoever is making decisions for you now that you're, you know, intubated or something and you're at the very end of your life. But a birth plan is supposed to do that. Unfortunately, what a birth plan has become is download my best birth plan. And it's like a list of checkboxes, as if having a baby is like a sushi menu, right? Like, you're not ordering sushi. You're not ordering from the like pick one menu at Burger King or whatever. You're having a fucking baby. Sorry for my language. So what I recommend people do is don't worry about writing a birth plan. Write your story. And every single person who wants to come in to your care team, you send them a copy of your story. And don't make it too long, but like really tell, speak from the heart. Who are you? What is important to you? What's your story coming up to this point? What's your goal going forward? Help them understand who you are so that they can align their resources towards your care. What I was mentioning before is that I've got all these tools, but I don't know which tools are best for you until I get to know you. And that's been a big part of why I've been so scorned by the medical system. I can't do my job if I have 7 minutes with you. I need 7 hours with you to really understand Angel Coleman before I can start recommending, this is the thing for you. This is what you should do. I don't know what to recommend until I know you. And if they don't know you, how are they going to help you make decisions? They're just going to tell you what they would do. And again, it's very fear-driven. It might be an experience they had in their own birth, and they're terrified of that happening to a client. So I would say write all of that down, make it very, very clear, and then invite your care team, whoever it is, to like explore that with you. It might only require 10 minutes. But if you don't have somebody, and Brad Boots Taylor in Georgia has a B score, he has like a template for this, specific questions to then ask your care team. in order to see, like, is this person the right person for me through this very sacred transformation, which is childbirth? It's not a medical procedure. So what is it? It's something way more important than that. And so your original question was, what can a person do in order to have their values honored? I think that's the best way to start. And to be very, very frank with yourself, I think it's also important to know who you are and what you stand for. Like, if you don't want to have an IV or any of the medicines and any of the monitoring, why are you in a hospital? Like, you don't go to the hardware store to buy eggs. So why would you go to a hospital if you want an undisturbed birth? It doesn't make sense. Like, I don't care what people say. You can't have an undisturbed birth in a hospital. It's just too many distractions, too many policies and procedures where they may honor what you wrote down in your story, but they have to do this. The nurse has to keep her job. Her charge nurse is telling you, her, if you don't do this, we're going to write you up. The doctors, their practice, their colleagues that they practice with, if you don't do it this way, you're going to lose your job. So if you don't want all the interventions, you have to ask yourself, would I be more comfortable with somebody like Angel and a midwife? You're a doula, right, Angel? Or are you a midwife?
I'm a doula on the track to becoming a midwife.
you could do both then. You could wear both hats. Of course, find a doula, find Angel when she's a midwife, and maybe have a birth in Cleveland at home. Like, maybe that's actually a better option for you so that you don't have to advocate and you feel like getting your birth plan notarized. Like, that actually matters. Nobody cares about your birth plan in the hospital. I'm sorry, but they don't. They have policies and procedures, and parts of that birth plan might fit in. But if it doesn't fit in, they're going to do the sort of rigmarole thing that they do. So you have to be very, very clear with yourself. This is where Dr. Stu and I very much get along. Like, I don't really care where you have a baby. I do suspect that if you don't want any of the things that the system is offering, I do think you probably need to be very, very honest with yourself, take accountability, and accept that I'm not going to get the birth that I want in a hospital. And then you have to worry about the bill. Do you crowdfund your birth? Do you sell something? Do you not get a new iPhone? Do you, like, where can you cut some costs? Can you cut a deal with your midwife whereby you do a payment plan? Like, there are a whole variety of things that you can do in order to make sure you have the birth. And it's not going to be that easy. It might be really, really hard to do that. But I promise you, there is somebody out there that wants to love you in the way that you want to be loved. You just have to be very frank with who you are and what you stand for.
Yeah, absolutely. And another tip for anyone who is looking to figure out how to fund their birth, you can use your income tax. I've used my income tax for a lot of ventures, including becoming a birth doula. So that's another tip for you guys. And
how does that work, Angel? How do you do that? Like, is it almost like a collateral? Like, I'll pay you my tax return when it comes through? Or is
I have. I've done that before. Like, I've hired a doula and I'm like, okay, you know, I get my tax return at this point in time, and can I pay you then? And they're like, yeah, sure, that's fine. And so, sometimes I've done exchange of services and things like that. So there are definitely ways to, you know, get around certain things if funding is a problem and things like that. Something else I wanted to talk about too, you may be wondering, and if you're new to this show, this is probably something you're wondering, but if you have been listening to my podcast, you probably already know, but you may be wondering, why is all of this important? Like, it's just a birth. But here is the truth. It's not just a birth. And this not only impacts you and this when it comes to how you remember birth and, you know, the pain and things like that. Like, it doesn't impact just you. It impacts your child. How you're born impacts the life of your child. I talk a lot about the microbiome. That's super important. Your birth impacts breastfeeding. And I talk a lot about that as well. So this isn't just a one-time thing that, like, it happens and then, you know, whatever, like, who cares? It's just that one time. But no, like, it does actually matter. And then you can actually pass on that trauma that you have in your birth to your children. When you talk about your birth later to your child, you're going to shape the view of their birth that they have. But if you have a traumatic birth, you're like telling your, you know, daughter who's going to have children one day, like, it was awful. I had a C-section and, you know, I would never want to do a vaginal delivery again. Like, you tore me from front to back and blah, blah, blah. Like, now they have this picture of what birth is, and they're going to pass that on to their next child, to their next pregnancy, to their next birth. And then it just keeps going down, 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 and down. And so I just, that is why this is so important. This is why I want to talk about this, because it is such an important thing that can impact human life, not just now, but, you know, for the totally. Lives to come. So
totally. Amen.
So the next thing that I want to ask you is that I know you're working on something. I know that you have come up with, I believe it's a course, right? Yeah, is that what you've been kind of doing lately?
Yeah. So what has happened because people are starting to spread my name around is that everybody has wanted me to attend their birth. So the prerequisite to me attending their birth is acknowledging that I don't have the capacity to see every single person. It's not just attending birth. It's also like, what do you think about this or that? And it's like, I can't answer 10 Instagram messages a day or all the emails. I do my very best. But what I was starting to realize, and this is in collaboration, sort of in cooperation with my friend Sarah Rosser, was that we needed like a program for people to go through and to learn the ins and outs of almost every single thing you'd ever want to know about pregnancy and postpartum, including, of course, the childbirth experience. But instead of just like, what's the evidence? Because it's not just a data issue. We have tons of data and we still don't have better outcomes. It's also a matter of reclaiming your power, taking some accountability for your actions, what you're putting into your body, how you're treating yourself, how you're loving yourself, your intimate connection with your partner. And, you know, all of that is to say, we put together this massive program. It's called the Born Free Method. And when people enroll, they get lifetime access, and we continue to add more content because I'm finding there's more and more and more that people want to know. So coming, I don't know when this episode's going to come out, but coming in January or February, we're relaunching it with a bunch of new content. There's guided meditations, there's checklists, there's exclusive interviews. There's so much there. And people who have taken it have told me, like, I don't even think I need to jump on a consult call anymore with you. They'd booked one and they're like, I've got everything I need in this program. So in addition, we do weekly calls for 12 months with people who enroll. So you've got all of the support. You're not in your siloed off world anymore. You've got a community of like-minded people. And we get into all the controversial things that nobody else is talking about, like pros and cons of ultrasound, pros and cons of vaccines. That's the one program. I've got another program that is launching very, very soon called Clear and Free, which is a holistic solution to persistent HPV, which we didn't really get into that here, but this is another thing that there's so much guilt and shame around HPV and pap smears and fear from the OBGYNs and nurse practitioners that are collecting these screens that people think as soon as they have an abnormal pap, that they're going to get cervical cancer. And so they go in 6 to 12 months for a repeat screen. In the meantime, nobody's giving them any tools or empowering them to take advantage of whatever their resources and their time and willpower can get them with regards to optimizing their immune system, their gut health, and all of the other amazing parts of the body that contribute to the end consequence years or decades later of cervical cancer. I mean, and then in the meantime, the LEAP procedures and all these excisions which impact your pregnancy and your fertility and all this. So that's where I'm at, since I don't have time to see every single person one-on-one, I'm creating these programs in order to make some really comprehensive, almost definitive guides for people out there who do jive with the way that I show up in the world. So
that's so awesome. And I know my audience will love that because my podcast is all about talking about the controversial things that nobody is talking about. And that's amazing. And I know you also mentioned nervous system, which is something that no one else is talking about. And I love how you mentioned that, oh yeah, we have all this evidence, which is great, right? We got the evidence but that's not what parents need. That's not what they need. They need to know how to take control of their birth and having that autonomy and things like that. So that is absolutely wonderful. Guys, if you are interested in any of these things, the link will be in the description below so that you guys can grab those links and check out all the programs that he offers and will be offering in the future. So, thank you, Nathan. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's always a pleasure to just listen to you. You have an abundant amount of wisdom, and we really appreciate you just straight talking to us and letting us know and giving it all to us. So this has been absolutely wonderful.
a real, it's always a privilege, Angel, to come onto somebody else's podcast. And I just find you, you're just delightful. So I hope to see you next year in Louisville. We'll hopefully some of your listeners will come and join us. Lots of simulations. We're doing some intensive simulation times there. And we've got people like Angelina Martinez Miranda's coming. We've got some trauma-informed care. Like, there's going to be so much there. So I can't wait to see you and your other Cleveland crew, Javon and everybody else, next year in Louisville. And if there's anything I can ever do to support you or any of your listeners, it's very easy to find me. So just come and find me, guys. I'm here. I'm just a regular guy.
Yes, you'll definitely see me there next year. And I hope to see you guys there with me, with Nathan, and with all the amazing other birth workers and perinatal healthcare workers who are just changing the birth world. So we'll see you guys in the next episode.
I hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast episode. But remember, our journey together is far from its conclusion. Ensure you tap that notification bell to stay in the loop about upcoming episodes. Don't forget the valuable resources waiting for you in the podcast description. Also, do you love this podcast? Show your love by leaving a stellar 5-star review, spreading the word across your social circles, or even becoming a listener supporter, contributing financially to sustain this podcast's existence. If a specific topic tickles your fancy or you aspire to be a guest on our show, don't hesitate to submit your ideas via the link in the podcast description. And to all you incredible women who are expecting or planning to conceive, I'm well aware that fears around childbirth can be overwhelming. From concerns about hospital procedures to coping mechanisms during labor, I've got your back. What's even better is that you can now access your free guide on mastering 5 techniques to conquer the fear of birth. As a bonus, discover a collection of mindfulness tools curated to quell anxiety and fear during pregnancy and childbirth. The guide's link awaits you in the podcast description. Live long, loud, and in prosperity, dear members of the Rebel Birth crew. Until we cross paths again, thrive unapologetically.